from sunny Rutland. And in fact, that's probably something we should talk about, because there's so much about entrepreneurship, particularly when it comes to recruiting and recruitment technology. People gravitate to the city, gravitate to London and stuff. So we definitely want to explore what it is like to be an entrepreneur outside of some of these major metropolitan spaces, because it could be that's a future that we need to explore more. For it will certainly democratize entrepreneurship, because you know, if people don't have to up sticks and, you know, change their lives to come into London and actually set up a viable business, no matter where you are, that's got to be a positive thing for a lot of people. Awesome. So anyway, we're live, everybody. We are live, folks. It is Founders Focus episode 30, and I'm absolutely delighted to be doing this. I'm kind of doing this at a rapid rate, mainly because I enjoy it so much. This is turning into the favorite thing for me to do every week. Because it is like a big learning journey for me to have conversations with people that have basically set up businesses and have basically set up businesses to try and solve recruiting problems, rather than just complaining about recruiting problems and, you know, getting on with business as usual the next day. So welcome to the show, everybody. And I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Anderson, MD of Crouton, to Founders Focus. So welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thanks, Hang. Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen, we ended up talking about regionalism, and I think we should just start there, because I think it is a cliche, and certainly pre-COVID, it felt as if you wanted to do something in business, or you wanted to do something in recruitment technology or whatever it might be, you'd have to go into a big city in order to do it, for the networking, for the fundraising, for the customers, all that face-to-face stuff and what have you. But you've obviously taken a different track pre-COVID. You didn't do this. Can I get your perspective on how it is to set up a business outside of major metropolitan centers like you have with Crouton, and I believe with your previous business as well?
Yeah. I mean, it was relatively straightforward for me. I was running a similar type of business for a big corporate who were, you know, operating outside London. I, you know, eventually decided to go off on my own. And actually, I'm not sure I would have done it if I wasn't able to drag some great talent with me who worked with me previously. So it was a bit of a no-brainer, really. There was no need for us to move out of the Midlands to London to get the business up and running. You know, I guess we may have considered developing a team in London in the future, but as we started off, I had access to some great talent, both from a tech perspective and from a recruitment perspective, in the Midlands. So, you know, for us, there was no need to try and find some expensive office space in London when actually we could get the business up and running from where we were.
That's the main thing, isn't it? Like the access to talent, you know, the concept that the best people are going to be in the bigger cities. And, you know, that's the way in which you would, at least you'd increase your chances of hiring those types of people. But you had the advantage, in a sense, you'd already work with people that they were happy to work with you. And so you solved those early employee issues, which can often really stall a business and you can't get your first couple of hires.
And you know, recruiting and being able to bring on, you know, a few people early on who you have complete faith in, who you know are probably a lot brighter than you are, who can help shape the business moving forward and can actually deliver operationally as well. So help to deliver some of the things that we were looking to do was a great start for us.
Does it make sense then as a, so if you could replay your entrepreneurship career back in time, does it actually then make sense to like join a big company in order to build a network of professionals that you might then set up businesses with? Or as it strikes me, they're two different entrepreneurial paths. Like if you emerged from university, let's say, and you just set up and went for it, you'd actually have like nobody you'd know that was able to do those things. You'd have to really, it's a different struggle early on.
Yeah. I think it's a lot harder if you're, you know, you have a great idea, but you don't have, you know, an operational team who can support you in terms of moving that forward from an idea to actually a, you know, a product or service that you can deliver. So, you know, I was in a great position, and you know, that path was a lot easier for us because, you know, those first few hires, I didn't need to particularly worry about. You know, I had to convince them to leave a big corporate where they, you know, had a relatively, you know, secure, you know, salary coming into to a new startup. But, you know, having convinced them, that puts in a, you know, a really good position. And of course, you know, the timings for us, we launched, you know, just a couple of months before the world, you know, came to a grinding halt, just, you know, a couple of months before the pandemic. So whether those people would have stuck it out, you know, for that first 12 months, if we didn't have a, you know, a strong relationship then, I don't know where that would have happened. So,
you see, this is why I'm a big fan of nepotism, Stephen, because you know, people criticize it, but bottom line is, if you've already built up social capital and trust relationships with those people, you're not going to be recruiting them or assessing them or whatever it is. You already know how they perform. They know how you perform. There's trust levels already there. You don't need to build it. That pre-building, that investment that you've done is just absolutely an accelerant to the early months of your time as a business. And as you say, it makes you resilient to those big changes. If they were complete strangers to you, they accepted a job and suddenly it all went pitong, you know what? How likely are you to hang on to them? Exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and those, you know, two key, you know, people who joined me right at the very beginning and, you know, took that leap of faith, they've helped shape the whole culture of the business. And without them, that would have been a real struggle. You know, we're still a relatively small business. You know, we've grown from, you know, the three of us to 20 odd now, over the last sort of couple of years. And most of that growth actually coming in the last 12 months. But without those two key people in place early on, for, you know, the culture, that level of, you know, engagement for every member of the team and buy-in, I think would have been really difficult.
Yeah, I think as I'm having these conversations, we're up to episode 30 now, so I'm speaking to all of these different journeys. Lots of people have got different paths. I spoke to Ilya Brodsky last week. He was saying, yeah, I just randomly sort of brought a few people on, and he will tell you that was a huge mistake. Because he spent the first 18 months trying to unwind all of that. And then there were a few young kids that just popped out of university and just went for it. And I'm just like massively in admiration of them, because I couldn't have done that. That's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy talk as far as I see it. but you know what I mean? What are you doing? But they've managed to do it. So credit to them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, going back to the point where you were yourself in a big corporate, Stephen, at what point did you feel, you know what, now is the time to set up on my own? Because you had another business prior to Cruton, didn't you? So you made that decision before. And what was in your mind that caused you to think, right, no more corporate, I got to do my own thing?
Okay, so I set up a service delivery, a business unit within this corporate, but it wasn't there. Core business, you know, their core focus was publishing, newspaper publishing, and actually as we grew, that the profits, the money that we were generating essentially was being fed back in to support another business. So, you know, we grew really quickly, but our growth trajectory was always going to be limited because actually we weren't able to reinvest, you know, that money that we were generating in terms of growing, in terms of marketing, broadening our reach. And so eventually, you know, the opportunity arose for me to leave and set up my own. And it just made perfect sense. And yeah, I'm so glad that I did. And, you know, it's always a bit of a leap of faith, particularly for, you know, for those people who joined me early on, that this is going to work. But, you know, as I said already, thankfully those people joined me and that made life a lot easier. You know, it would have been a very lonely journey, particularly with what happened in 2020 with the lockdown. You know, I can imagine myself sitting in a room at home on my own for a year going, oh my God, what have I done? But thankfully I had some great people around me. And from there, we've been able to, we've recruited really well and, built a really strong team. So.
Was there a moment, and by the way, Stephen, I do recognize how painful that might be when you're operating a kind of a growing business unit in a wider group that wasn't growing at the same pace, so was actually going in a different direction, and you were basically it was kind of like vampirically taking the work you were doing and then feeding it to other places. So that must have been a period of time. Was there a particular moment that you can recollect where you thought, you know what, I'm definitely out? Was there like a single event that you can think of or a moment in time where you realize, okay, we're going to do this?
I think, the business was going through a number of changes. It had changed ownership a number of times over a, 2-3 year period. I'm not getting any younger. I had to make that choice now. Is there ever a right time? I've got a young family, as well as a sort of some grown up kids as well. So, it was risky, but, I knew if I left it any longer, I'd never do it. So it was right, do it now, or, you're never going to be able to do it.
Was it always going to be on the cards for you to run your own business, Stephen? Did you always have that in your mind, or was this a combination?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't always been in recruitment. When I left university, I went into food retail and catering with my sister. We had a couple of delis in West London and a catering business. thankfully was surrounded by people with real talent. My sister is, an amazing cook, chef. And I just did the, front of house glory, the nice bit really. So I did that soon after university and that was great fun. Did that for 7 or 8 years, sold that business. Moved out of London to Norfolk, ended up working for this large corporate newspaper publisher. I'd got a taste early on of what being self-employed was like, and it was tough. And actually I made, a hideous number of mistakes. I was really green. I thought it was all about expansion and growth, and actually really didn't focus as much as I should have done on the bottom line, and actually look at where your core revenue streams are coming from. We were doing weddings, big corporate events, lunchtime sandwich trade, but actually if I'd sat back and gone, right, where's the money coming from, I'd have probably gone, right, sandwiches, great, actually we can make an awful lot of money opening for a few hours a day and then we've got a life back. But ended up working 15-hour days, getting up, going to the market in the morning at 4 a.m, not finishing to 8 or 9 in the evening. I've always wanted to get back into running a business and feel that I'm probably in a better position now to actually make success of it, rather than being young, straight out of university and thinking you know it all.
Do you know what? Some of these lessons are timeless, aren't they, Stephen? You're talking exactly about doing non-scalable stuff compared to scalable stuff. Now it's all startup speak, so we understand it. But it's the same. Business is the same everywhere. If you're doing things that are exciting, individuated projects that need like huge customization and whatever, and yes, there might be a big ticket item, wedding might be 20 grand or whatever it is, might be a big ticket at the end of it. My goodness, the amount of effort that is there and the diversion of energy is huge.
Taking on additional staff to manage those single projects. We always, when it came back to it, all the margins were always on that high volume lunchtime trade, which we were great at. But there you go.
It, folks. Listen, lesson entrepreneurship lesson number one is just understand where core revenue is. So core revenue is basically your most literally bread and butter. I mean, you're talking about sandwiches. It is your bread and butter. It's the stuff that always goes in, super reliable. And most importantly, things that you know how to do. So in other words, you know how to actually produce the product, sell the product, and get the money in. There's none of that ambiguity. Whereas if you're catering for a wedding, guess what? Bright, there's all kinds of customizations you're going to need to do. Last minute changes, complete. You have zero control over this. You're kind of like riding a rhino, you know? It's like you're not in control of this thing.
Absolutely. And so, I guess, you know, so lockdown really helped us focus on what our core was going to be. And actually, you know, we always knew healthcare and FMCG was going to be part of the mix for us. But actually, we were really forced to focus on those sectors where actually, you know, recruitment continued during that period. And we've come out the other side with a really strong client base in those sectors. And that's, you know, we're now really grateful for that because, you know, that is our bread and butter. We've got some great relationships with clients in those sectors. We're working more and more with them. And we've got a great base to build from now.
How do you balance this requirement to do business as usual, core revenue, with the necessary requirement to also expand into exciting opportunities? So you don't want to deny yourself a potential opportunity, but at the same time, you can't be like putting extraordinary risk onto what are sexy projects that don't come in. So as a leader of a business that's had, you know, you've had a couple of decades playing with this idea now, Stephen, have you developed some sort of formula where you can analyze it as an opportunity and think, that's worth doing because it's repeatable. That's not worth doing because it's like, you know, hard to redo or whatever. I mean, do you think like this or?
You're absolutely right. You get drawn and excited by potentially moving into new sectors and we might do some analysis in terms of what would the opportunity be? How much are we going to invest in terms of, you know, upskilling our team to deliver on those projects? And 99% of the time you go, actually, it's probably really not worth us moving into that sector. I think for us it's now, you know, our core is volume recruitment, and I think it always will be. And we just need to build out from that. You know, there are lots of areas for the business to grow in terms of, you know, big data, using the data that we're collecting to help, you know, our clients make informed decisions about, you know, hiring moving forward. So it's building on our core strengths rather than being distracted by, you know, some, you know, recruitment over there, which might be, you know, look incredibly attractive in terms of revenue streams, and but actually would divert our attention away from our core offering.
You know what? I came across this term earlier today, and I kind of tweeted out because I thought it was really, really quite profound. But the orientating mission of your business doesn't have to be inspirational per se. It just needs to be clear. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't. Like, sometimes I think people say, "What is your North Star?" And then, you know, we expect some sort of like a Gandhi-esque type profundity coming out. But actually, no, it could be very clear. It's like, I am actually trying to provide to this particular market.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm doing. That's great. That's all you need. It doesn't have to be some sort of, you know, ethical or moral type of value. It's simply what orientates your action for you and the rest of the team. I think that's absolutely something, you know, we struggle with mission statements, I think, because we want to try and make them inspirational, but we just need to be clear.
Absolutely. And if we're going to grow, we need to be able to communicate what we do clearly and effectively to potential clients. And I think, you know, it's taken a little bit of time for us to get there, but I think we are now absolutely clear in terms of our space, what we need to be telling clients, and they need to understand it, whether, you know, they're a CEO, an MD of a big, you know, corporate, or somebody who works in the recruitment field. I think, you know, it's important that those senior decision makers completely understand what what we're going to do for them. And I think we've been lucky that we've been able to demonstrate, you know, real value and an impact on the bottom line for our clients, which is why I think we're in, you know, I believe we're in a good position to grow now, because, you know, it's a clear measurable results that we're delivering for our clients.
And I'll give you a second to just to tell us what it is Crucial Undo, actually, because we haven't covered that. But one thing that's worth bearing in mind, people at C-level, generally, I wouldn't say they're immune to sales, but they really do value brevity because they don't have the time. So you need to be just very clear. A no is a no, and no one's going to care. But they just need to, you need to help the C-level just pass through all of the noise they get and say, look, we do this for this number. And this way, this is our process. Do you want to have another chat? That's almost all you need half the time. Okay, Stephen, tell us about Crouton. How would you describe it? Give us two lines. What kind of business is this? And, you know, who should care about it?
Okay, so as we've alluded to a number of times, you know, volume agreement is our, you know, is our thing. We offer a blend of recruitment resourcing with some really interesting tech. So we're not purely a recruitment tech company. We use some interesting tech around geofencing to be able to reach an audience in a different way. You know, we use job boards and social media platforms, but we also use digital display in a very targeted way to reach candidates that our clients would be interested in attracting to roles. But we've got a team of, you know, recruiters who then help manage that process and screen candidates. And the output at the end of the day is we're providing a short list of candidates that our client really want to progress through to the next stage.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I love the blended approach, Stephen. I started myself and I attempted to do a completely automated way to deliver service. Truth of the matter is customers didn't want that. You know, they want to have some sort of concierge. They want to have some sort of person, because they recognize it's a human process. And if the supplier doesn't do it, the customer has to do it, because nothing is entirely automated, at least not yet. So I love the fact that you have technology to acquire the candidates, but you have recruiters to basically guide and, you know, move people through the process.
Yeah, because, you know, there is no one way. There's, you know, how we screen candidates for a particular role. It might maybe the same job title, but the way that, you know, the requirements for a different client could be quite different. And our clients love that human interaction. They love that we've got some, you know, really interesting, groundbreaking tech, which allows us to reach a different audience that they're not able to access in other ways. But actually, we've got people who are going to support them on that journey and deliver some great candidates at the end. And the pricing model is different. You know, it's a low price point. You know, it's not an expensive service. And then for the volume piece, you know, we're providing maybe half a dozen candidates, and the client may end up recruiting all of those candidates at no additional cost. So we think we've got, you know, a compelling offering which sits quite nicely, you know, between recruitment agency, in-house team, and, you know, more traditional tech offerings.
Yeah, that's right. And the pricing is exciting. Explain that a little bit, Stephen. So it's just a one-off monthly, isn't it?
Actually charge on a campaign. So you know, for example, you know, we've got some big FMCG clients, so they're looking for production operatives. For a single upfront fee of, you know, £700-£800, we'll run a campaign for them for a month. And the output for them is, right, you know, we've done lots of clever things to fill that funnel at the top. And the output is we've got 10, 15 great candidates that they'll want to interview and potentially hire. So the cost per hire, you know, could be £100 if as an output from that campaign.
Yeah, that's like extraordinary cost savings. And by the way, you know, one of the big, it's still one of the priority concerns for businesses and in-house recruiters to try and reduce third-party spend. Because sometimes if you do hire and you lean a little bit too heavily on third-party, those costs can escalate. But if you're in a position where you can actually just lock it down to really sub 1,000 type of per campaign, you can understand how that makes perfect sense, particularly if you're hiring more than one role, multiple hires and what have you. Very interesting indeed. Okay, Stephen, let's talk about sort of things, kind of leadership approach. How would you stylize or characterize your own approach to leadership of your business?
I think, you know, at the moment, my focus is on ensuring that we hire well, every hire is right, that we create a culture within the team where everybody feels that they have a real voice. You know, we've taken on a number of interns, so one chap via the Kickstart program, which has worked out brilliantly. I know some people have had less, favorable experiences, but, we took somebody on in a sort of recruitment administrative role. They're now managing some of our ad ops in a more analytical role. So I think I'm really just trying to create an environment where people feel they have a voice and can really contribute. And everybody does, the direction and shape of the business isn't just me. This is everybody's input in terms of where we go, who we should be talking to, what services we should look to be offering moving forward. So I think it's a pretty flat management structure. And maybe that's one of my failings sometimes, is that, I assume everybody, I have complete faith in most of my team, and actually, and we obviously catch up all the time and we're talking all the time, but I probably have failed over the last 12 months in terms of, formal one-to-ones and appraisals and doing all that sort of type of thing, because, I know how valuable those things are from sitting on the other side of the desk and being appraised, and that could be a really valuable exercise. So we've recently taken on a head of people who's helping us, manage that growth and make sure that we don't lose any of that. And that's my biggest worry, really, is as we grow, how do we ensure that we remain, a team? I love coming to work. I think most of my team, well, I know they do enjoy coming to work, and that's why most of them come into the office every day. They don't need to, but they choose to. So that's where we are. I just hope we can. My role is to make sure that we can maintain that as we grow, I think.
Two things to mention there, Stephen. What your failings as a leader, so we'll go back to that. But also the fact that you are obviously in an office right now, and you mentioned that people are coming in even though there's no mandate to do so. What do you think of this battle? It seems that there's a battle going on between people who want to do remote and people who want to go work from home. We saw Elon Musk famously say, listen, in the office, if you're not in the office, actually, we're going to fire you, or something to that effect. And then you got lots of like Tesla employees saying, yeah, I'm leaving. And then it's like, okay, like, what's your take on this? Do you think there is some like fundamental reason or value that coming together in a team in person provides that remote doesn't provide, or do you think it's just like antediluvian management? What's your view on this?
I think it's really difficult. I think it very much depends on the sector that you're operating in and the type of service you're delivering. I feel there's real value in getting together, and particularly at this point in our journey, we are early feeding stage. Off each other the whole time. Mm-hmm. From a sales team perspective, I know, my sales commercial team, they love being around other salespeople. We bounce off other salespeople. I think it can be quite a lonely existence,
100%.
In a bedroom, trying to bang out 50 calls a day, that's...
Let me just interrupt you right there. I've got a friend of mine who works for a recruitment agency. He's fully remote. And he is actually looking for a sales team to sit next to Because he's literally by himself. He can't work in the house because he freaks him out. He goes to a WeWork or he goes to a shared space. Everyone's a computer worker. They're all like literally, you know, headphones on. They're not doing calls. He feels awkward doing that. But he misses that buzz. He misses the atmosphere, even the hearing of other how sales calls are being made, just the ambience or information. Absolutely. He's missing that. And he literally said to me, do I know anybody that has a sales team that he could just sit next to? He'd rent the seat. He just wants to hear the buzz. And I'm thinking, you know what? There's probably...
He's more than welcome to come in and sit with us as long as he promises not to steal any of our clients.
There you go, Steve. He's in a different market. Go and have go up to Peterborough if you fancy the journey.
A desk.
But there's something going on there, isn't there? Because you wonder, with recruiting in particular, being very much a sales-based job, let's be honest with that and not be ashamed. It's outbound, and it is a lot of conversations still on phone, particularly if you're hiring high volume. People aren't, you know, typing away on email all the time. If you're hiring for manual workers and whatnot, it is a phone call. It is a text. So is there a sort of a situation where we can get recruiters or salespeople or groups of people together in order to independently work for different companies? Because I think there's more than one person struggling.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge, isn't it? You know, if you're working in, you know, sales, if it's completely a different sales proposition, then fine, that could work. I think lots of recruiters working for different companies might be a bit of a challenge, but look, I think there's definitely a lot to be said for having a team working together, you know, and our sort of account managers who, you know, are working with clients and talking to clients. Again, there's real value in being able to just shout across the table, oh God, have you worked on a role in that market? You know, what's it like? You know, what have you done differently for a particular client? So there's an awful lot of conversation going on, you know, but certain roles, you know, I completely get it. And we give obviously some flexibility there because, you know, some days actually you just need to get your head down and, you know, you really need to be focused on banging out 200 calls or whatever it happens to be, or you've got some admin to do. So I think it's very difficult to be really prescriptive because I think it differs from company to company.
Yeah, I think as I'm putting together a talk right now, and I'm beginning to try, I want to try and create some sort of framework where people can analyze how, you know, how remotable jobs are, so to speak, you know, because there's lots of things to think about. You got to think about the complexity of the job. You got to think about the collaboration intensity of it. You got to think about the journey, the maturation of the company, right? Guess what? If you're a big organization, big corporate, you're Deloitte Touche or whatever, yeah, sure, you can work from wherever. That's totally fine. They're like 100-year business. They already have processes, systems, and what have you. Yeah. If you're a 1-year, 2-year startup, you're just evolving these systems, might be a different story. You know, it might be you need to get people in. So maturation of company, you know, all kinds of things go into it. It's not straightforward. Work from home is good.
And it depends on the individual. I mean, we have a couple of sales people who do work remotely and it works for them. And, you know,
individuals, well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're, you know, they are quite happy. And they manage to motivate themselves. You know, I just know I'm not a salesperson, but I know I would find it very difficult to do on my own, banging out those calls every day. So, you know.
There's also an age thing as well, so to speak, because it looks like the early entry talent definitely wants to be in office, or at least in a milieu where they're interacting with people that are also in, because that's where they get the training and they're learning and stuff like this. And we shouldn't forget, of course, that the younger you are in your life, the less likely you are to have the domestic arrangements to support quality work at home. You might be sharing a flat, you might be on a kitchen table somewhere, you might be still living with your parents, you know, all kinds of stuff going on that might intrude with your ability to perform. So lots of things to think about on all of that. Okay, let's talk about leadership failings, Stephen. Not to lean on this overly much, but you identified something already with, you know, you kind of over the chaos of the growth and stuff, you let slip some of the operational HR people stuff. How do you as a leader improve? How do you as an individual think, you know what, I am actually an asset for the company. I need to also keep myself in shape and keep improving going forward. Do you have any kind of ways to do that? Like, how do you make sure you're the best MD or the best leader of the company?
Yeah, good question. I was talking to our head of people this morning about this, and and that is really important that, you know, I continue to develop. You know, we've got some big plans over the next few years. We want to grow from a national player to a global player. And that's a big transition and something new to me. So we're looking at, mentorship programs to support me in terms of that growth and that development. I've got my co-founder is fantastic as well. And, I'm always learning from him. He's not from a recruitment background, but an ad tech background. So, I'm always learning from him. He's always, challenging me, making me, think about things in a different way. So yeah, I think that's hugely important. But as a manager and an MD, I also know, because I know how important it is. I need, however capable I think my team are, I need to be setting aside some time to make sure that, they're getting the support and the time with me that they need or might need. I don't know whether they need me or not, but I need them to give them that opportunity to in a maybe slightly more formal way to discuss their career path and what they'd like to be doing and any challenges they're facing.
Well, now that the head of people's in place, hopefully that structure will be put into place. And yeah, it's great to know that conversation is being had with yourself as a member of the team. Because I do think that leaders of companies oftentimes neglect their own value to the business because they're too busy firefighting, too busy taking care of the group. And oftentimes the personal neglect is deleterious because you're actually one of the key assets for the key asset for the business in many cases. You imagine some of these big companies out there, even, the biggest tech companies, which are these days market cap biggest companies anywhere, what would they be if, Zuckerberg actually was operating at 50%? This is not good. You need to get him right at the leading edge in order to do all of those good things. Stephen, in terms of the kind of decisions that you've made, what has been the best decision you've made with Crouton since you launched the business? So launching the business, obviously a great idea, but there must have been moments in the last 2 or 3 years where there was a yes, no, left, right type of call that you had to make. Can you think of one where you thought, right, that was a 50-50, but I made it and it actually came off? A properly tough decision, but it actually worked out in your favor.
I think it probably came early on. I was talking to my co-founder this morning about, those early months and when we were doing Zoom calls and, the world had just locked down. And he said, look at your face. Looking at my face then, it was, oh my God, what have we done? How are we going to survive this? But I think, we made a call. Maybe it was a pretty obvious call, but we decided early on, right, to get through this, we really need to focus on a couple of key sectors. We need to be, singular about going after, and identifying healthcare companies that we can support, and those FMCG clients who are continuing to recruit. So it was making that call early on, I guess, and that helped us through that really difficult period. And we came out the other side, smaller. We had massive, forecasts and projected numbers for that first year of trading, and of course it was about, getting through and making sure that, you know, we stayed a team, you know, and we did, and we won some great clients, and we, you know, I'm proud about some of the work that we did. You know, we helped the NHS find, you know, staff at a really difficult period, you know, so, you know, people providing COVID jabs and, you know, for some of the trusts, which was great. And, but we, so look, I think that was probably, you know, the most important thing, because, yeah, we could have quite easily folded after a few months if we hadn't really, you know, focused on those sectors where, you know, we felt we could have some real value and actually, you know, I think deliver, you know, a really valuable service at that time.
You know what? I'm just reviewing some of the data because, as I mentioned, I'm preparing this talk I'm about to give, but just looking at some of the historical data, and it does feel like so long ago now. Even, you know, the first lockdown period, it was a catastrophic a collapse of the economy, and many businesses did indeed fold, and they've gone away. You know, we don't know what's happened to the people who are working there. Maybe they've left the recruiting industry, maybe they've done something else. So it's anybody who's gone through that period and survived it, I think, is in great shape. What's your prognosis for the future, Stephen? It looks like we've had this really you know, crazy boomeranging type of feeling where big collapse 2020, then suddenly we grew again in a huge way 2021, where couldn't hire candidates, couldn't hire recruiters. It was like desperate stuff. Everything we were looking forward to, like, you know, the swinging 20s, as the people were talking about. And then 2022, we start thinking, oh no, inflation, conflict in Ukraine, obviously, rising energy prices, VC starting to pull back. Layoffs starting to happen in tech. Is that going to start bleed through? What's your prognosis for the rest of this year, and in fact the rest of the decade? How do you see it all panning out?
Big question. Look, I think clearly it's going to be a really, you know, tough couple of years. I think some sectors are going to see a shrinking. I think there will be inevitably be more layoffs, redundancies. I think we're relatively lucky in that, you know, we're operating particularly in sectors which, you know, inevitably can't shrink. You know, healthcare support workers, that as a resource will need to continue. You know, people are still going to need to eat food, and so some of the companies that we're working, you know, globally, will, you know, they'll continue to trade. So, you know, I think we're relatively secure, but I can see it's going to be really tough across, you know, the IT sector, as you mentioned. It's going to be a tough few years. And look, I don't have a golden ball, you know, a crystal ball. Beyond that, who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like I say, some people accuse me of trying to talk us into a recession, which, you know, obviously would not be thrilling for me. But I do, you know, look at it, and it seems like it's we're due to have a big correction here. So yeah, I'd be interested to see how recruiters respond as an industry. Although the positive thing about recruiters is that, generally speaking, we're very sensitive to change and we're quick to change. I don't think recruiters are particularly innovative as a category of person. You know, I think we're too motivated by the cash. So, you know, and that's a good thing in the sense that we're going to go and do the thing that's going to make the money. But once the money dries up, then we pivot again to think what is going to make the money. And I think that's always been the thing that's been able to help recruiters, kind of true recruiters who aren't just sitting on a, you know, a booming market, but ones that have gone through a few of these bumps and bruises. The ones that have gone through typically are the ones that are able to quickly switch and pivot into a different sector.
It's far too reactive. We need to be thinking, right, planning for what might, you know, what might come. And, you know, I was thinking about, sorry.
Recruiters never do that, though. They can never do it. I think it's purely due to the kind of performance measures that recruiters have. It's always monthly target. It's always yearly target. Where are you to target? And if you've hit your target, then suddenly you get accelerators. So you just got to keep maxing out on that. And then there's no scope for future thinking or future planning. So I don't think we're very good at it. Structurally, we're not designed for it. We're reliant on being able to bounce away when something bad happens, you know.
We're very lucky. I feel very lucky that, you know, we have managed to develop a really strong sales team. And of course, you know, they're driven by a monthly target. But actually, you know, they want us to succeed. They're in it. You know, I think all of them are in it for the long term, you know, and they have options in the business, obviously. So it's, you know, financially, you know, there's an incentive there for them. But, you know, when one, you know, I was chatting to one of my team the other day, and, you know, he smashed his target last month. But, you know, it was more, for him, it was more about how we were doing as an overall team rather than his individual number, which, you know, that's great to have people who care about their number, but actually really genuinely care about the overall number is, you know, is a great position to be in.
It's really hard to do, to have compensation that works on both of those things, to get people thinking on individual performance and also group performance. I've been in situations where obviously recruitment and third party is typically always like 100% you, so almost you almost don't care often about the state of the business. It's crazy as it might sound, it's like your target is you. And that's basically traditional recruiting, but then you have other models of other ways in which you're paying, where it's all sort of comped against group and team, and then you get some complaints to say, look, there's a lack of urgency sometimes, you know, the responsibilities to get it done are diffused across the group, sometimes you don't necessarily get people activated. I remember going to a private event a couple of weeks ago in Berlin, and it was mainly HR folks, and they were actually saying, yeah, we need to actually put some of these recruiting comp packages into HR, because the people are lack urgency. They just pay the basic, and you know what, they're not getting as much done as we could because it's the same old same old. So some sort of performance component, target-driven component might actually work. So I'd be very interested to know who's doing what in compensation. I think it's actually a really innovative space. You might have noticed one of the things that has emerged in recent years has been the emergence of compensation tech, where you've got companies that are trying to provide market intelligence as to how different compensation frameworks are being paid, who's being paid what, how do you as a business stay competitive within the whatever parameters you have. And I'm thinking, actually, that's really good. That's like trying to put a little bit of innovation in something which has traditionally always been driven by convention, basically. You know, we've all just rolled out stuff we're used to and not being aware how that influences behavior downstream. Let's forecast just this year and just next 12 months, Stephen. What exciting things can customers of Crouton, should I say, expect from you? What kind of stuff are you pushing out to them that they can be excited about?
Yeah, so look, we the last year and a half, we really focused on that back end system for our clients to manage those shortlisted candidates that we've been providing. You know, and it's slick, it's simple. You know, our clients love using it. What we now want to do is build that forwards to allow our clients to engage more easily with us. You know, we have clients who, you know, might be giving us 20 roles a week. Now, sometimes they haven't got the time to pick up the phone and give us that instruction. So we're building a self-serve platform which would allow our users to go in, select the ad creative, their digital display advert they want to use, select some screening questions to allow us to streamline that process, and as a result also give them, you know, a front-end dashboard where they can really see some data around how campaigns are delivering and source of candidates and that type of thing. So we think that will, you know, that is being driven by, you know, client requests really. So we know there's a requirement. We're not, you know, just developing something and hoping it will stick. You know, this is a lot of our development all the way through has been, you know, and what we do next is being driven by, you know, clients saying, actually, you know, we would really like to be able to do this or that. And then we'll look at developing that out. And I think for us, that's, you know, that's the way to go. You know, we're working with some global clients, largely in the UK at the moment, but they're, you know, opening up, you know, opportunities for us to work with them globally. So we need to have, you know, a great interface that will allow us to scale very quickly in international markets. So
yeah, I think so. And that kind of, you know, all of these small moments that, you know, typically were very analog, you know, the collection of requirements, for instance, you know, whether that's in person or via email or phone or whatever, that can so easily get lost and so easily just be an issue. You create a bit of innovation, small bit of innovation, but suddenly you just get massive gains in efficiency and you get the customer basically much happier because they can see things happening. They don't have to rely on somebody getting back to them and then, oh, person's on holiday for 2 weeks. So what's happened to my requirement? Like, you don't know. But now it's like, okay, self-serving it. We can see it's all there.
Absolutely. And it means we're freeing up more time for our team to actually speak to clients when they need to speak to clients and speak to candidates, which is, you know, that's where the real added value comes from that team is, you know, the time they spend really, you know, talking to clients about particular problems or what we could do differently to attract talent, or reaching out to candidates directly. So that's a big focus for us this year, but also, you know, with an eye on big data and actually using some of the data we're collecting to really start mapping out what's happening in the market and be able to feed that back to clients and the industry about, you know, where movement is, what they should be looking at doing next.
Absolutely right. Market intelligence, being able to provide more value than just the provision of candidates. I think that's always been something that, you know, way back when something third-party suppliers have needed to be doing, but difficult for them to do. So I think this is part of the reason why I'm really attracted to companies like yours, Stephen, that has this blended approach. There is a human element. There is a technology element. The combination of those means you can actually then produce stuff that, you know, neither side would be able to do if it were there by themselves.
You know, from a research perspective, it's not just quantitative, it's, you know, it's the qualitative research that we can be doing, and we're looking at that actually, how much can we do around that to add real value for our clients.
Well, here's the reason why, you know, the disintermediation of human recruiters has not yet happened, despite number of attempts to do it. And I think it'll still be resistant. And it's something that's kind of been late in my kind of understanding of it. But it's all of the informal information that's not documented. Oftentimes, it's not official. Oftentimes, it can't be documented or officially talked about. It's all of that stuff that is collected by recruiters because they are third party, because they are a little bit outside of the structures of a customer or of a business, and they can operate in that way. Imagine same way with candidates. Sometimes candidates can't be on the market and be visible and do all of those things. They want to be confidential, but they want to get things going. What are the choice? What are the options to do that? Other than have back channel is actually a way, is probably has a negative connotation, but you know what I mean. It's all of that kind of informal, non-documented information that recruiters routinely collect through just talking to people. You know, and by that collection, you'll have a different picture from than if you just relied on what's documented. And that is the reason.
And again, if we can blend the two, if we can give some context around, you know, some of the data that we're collecting, then we feel that there's real value there for our clients.
Looking into the recruitment technology market, Stephen, what things excite you outside of Crouton? I mean, obviously you're focused on your business and obviously you're doing your own thing, but have you kind of looked at recruiting tech out there and looked at any sort of innovations and you think, you know what, that's actually really quite cool. Have you seen anything like that recently?
I wish I had more time to, you know, and that's one of the things that, you know, I need to focus on moving forward is actually spend more time analysing the market and seeing what's going on. Look, there's lots of companies doing some really clever stuff. I actually do think there's quite a lot of, you know, you said recruiters aren't, you know, maybe as innovative as they might be. But actually, there's lots of really exciting stuff happening around the diversity piece and people starting to look at big data. But, you know, I'm not sure I could pick out one for you.
That's totally fair enough. I get what you're saying. You know, I don't mean to denigrate recruiters at all. I still think of myself very much as a recruiter. I just think the reason why I frame it in this way on innovation is simply because I don't think recruiters have the time to do it. I mean, I spoke to Victor Nordy last week. He is the founder of Adway, and he actually resigned, I think, from his leadership role to be an R&D guy for his business because he knew he wanted to do innovation, but he couldn't operate the business while still being an innovator. Yeah. And I think recruiters basically operate their own business at the individual level. And so you just don't have time. A very kind of first sort of attempt at launching a business for myself was when I realized that I was working in recruiting in a recruitment agency, doing well, but I wanted to investigate technology, investigate what was going on. I couldn't do it, even though the boss had given me license to do it. I said, Hung, it's all right, you can take day off to do focus on this. And I said, yeah, great, I'll do that. I couldn't do it because there was interrupts happening, customer problem, oh crap, maybe I need more candidates on this, you know, before, there's always that stuff, right? So I think that the nature of the job basically means it's going to be a struggle. And I think we'll tend to be more reactive, and that's a good thing, rather than, you know, be able to plan out. But that's my characterization of the industry per se. Okay, Stephen, for the people who are listening to this, they may be working in recruitment agencies right now, or maybe they're working in some sort of company, and they may be thinking at one point, you know what, I wouldn't mind setting up my own business at one point, be it as a recruiter or be it as a different type of business. Can you think of any bits of advice that you could give that person? Like, what sort of guidance would you give them if they have never done any entrepreneurship before? What should they know? What should they look out for?
Okay, I think it's a couple of things. I think if you're going to do it, make sure you're clear about your messaging. What is your differentiator? How are you going to stand out from the crowd? And then I think it's around, you know, going off on your own and being a one-man band can be a lonely existence. If you're thinking about a team, make sure you get those first couple of hires absolutely right. You know, if you're an ideas person, make sure you've got, you know, somebody who's operational who can actually deliver, you know, something for you. I think those are the two key things. Make sure you've got a clear differentiator. Make sure you get those first few hires spot on.
That's really good advice. And there may be a strategy there. Like, oftentimes, if you're in work right now, one of the things you should be doing, and you want to be an entrepreneur, one of the things you should be doing is constantly collecting future co-founders, right? Constantly collecting, you know, future first hires. Like, this is why you should treat, I mean, obviously you should be altruistic in any way, but you just never know the interactions you have with anybody in your work. They could emerge into being people that would have a different role to play in a different plan that you might have for your own future. So you can't just be instrumental with every approach, like get candidates off the phone or get clients off the phone, or you don't have time to speak to this person. You got to make that time because you don't know what value is going to come out of that. Yeah. Okay, Stephen, listen, really great speaking with you. Obviously, you're a very, you're a very busy man. So what busy things do you have to get on with after we finish this conversation, Steve? What MDing activities are going to happen after this?
I'm going to go have a lie down for a few minutes.
strenuous the trauma of having a conversation oh my goodness. I totally get it.
So what have I got on? Actually mapping out, we're doing some work around how mapping out the team and structure moving forward. You know, we know we're gonna have to make some key appointments over the forthcoming months. So how is that gonna look? We're slammed in terms of development work at the moment, getting the documentation ready in terms of getting that next stage of the tech rollout developed. And then I'm off to play golf. It's somehow one of my colleagues has roped us into some charity golf event. I don't play golf. I'm absolutely terrified. I'm not sure how I'm going to get around the course. It's,
oh, no. Is it a full?
It's a key client as well. So I really don't
know. Is it 18 holes? Are you playing the full?
Yeah, it's 18 holes, championship golf course.
Oh. Mate, if you've never played, you're gonna good luck. Golf is one of those games which is amazing to play, but you need a baseline. You need a baseline of competence, which I don't have, by the way. Hence why I hate golf, because it basically means I'm spending like 6 hours on the course hacking away, getting increasingly annoyed, and then also embarrassing yourself as you're getting annoyed. So the entire thing is just a nightmare. Anyway, yeah. I'm sure you have natural talent. You're going to go in there and ace it. Stephen Anderson, really good chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time. Good luck with you and your business and your round of golf, sir. So thank you very much.
Okay. Jason, thanks a lot.
What a great guy, hey? That's Stephen Anderson, MD of Crouton. So I guess if you're hiring for high volume folks in the FM, sort of fast moving goods space, or in the healthcare sector, check out Crouton. That's crouton.com. They may have a very compelling offer for you, particularly as it seems that they're not charging per hire. So great solution to look at. Anyway, that's about it, folks. Thank you for watching. We're back tomorrow. We're with Figures, the CEO of Figures is Virgil Ringard. I probably have completely masked his name there, but I'll get that right tomorrow. We're going to be talking about compensation tech, as we mentioned earlier. We're going to be speaking at the same time tomorrow on episode 31 of Founders Focus. And we'll be back on Brain Food Live on Friday, where we are talking about recession-proofing your recruitment career. We've got Neil Carberry and Dorothy Dalton and the great Vanessa Rath joining us. Make sure you follow us along there. Register to the show and follow the channel. That's it. Thanks for watching.